This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: three U.S. military bases hosting U.S. occupation forces in eastern Syria come under a rocket attack hours apart. Russia says it has killed over 200 Ukrainian troops in a railway station attack in central Ukraine. Also coming up, Rohingya Muslim refugees rally across their squalid refugee camps in Bangladesh to mark 5 years since they fled a brutal military crackdown in Myanmar. Thanks for joining us. Reports coming out of the Syrian province of Deir al-Zor suggest that another U.S. military base has come under attack shortly after strikes occurred on other bases. Now, according to Syrian media, explosions were heard as several rockets landed inside the base of the Conoco oil field hours ago. So far, no word on possible casualties. Meanwhile, U.S. forces have sealed off the area, with warplanes flying overhead. Late on Wednesday, rockets struck two military bases hosting U.S. troops in the same province, injuring three American troopers. A day earlier, the U.S. military carried out airstrikes in eastern Syria, claiming it targeted the facilities used by Iran-linked fighters. Tehran has slammed the raids as a breach of Syria's sovereignty, also denying U.S. military claims that the targets were linked to Iran. Damascus is opposed to U.S. military presence on its soil, which it says is to plunder the nation's resources, particularly oil. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali explains why the U.S. claims that Iran-linked groups target its bases in Syria are false.
This is the second time that the U.S. In 24 hours claims that those groups targeting it are linked to Iran. While we all know that Iran has no troops or forces in Syria, yes, there are some military advisors at the request of the Syrian government, but there are no troops, and the United States never actually gave any proof that those groups, as it claims, are linked to Iran. This is first what happened, and then after that attack, the U.S. Central Command, in a statement, said that it responded back using helicopters to the source of fire, killing two or three individuals that used a car to attack that site over there. Now, what is very important to point out to is that this time there has been there were three U.S. soldiers injured. Now, it could be any popular group in that area, people of that area, that are sending messages to the United States that you are occupying our territories, you are stealing our oil, and you should leave. This is perhaps how analysts see and people see such attacks against the U.S. Forces of occupation in Syria. They want them out because they are stealing their oil, they are dividing the country, they are supporting terrorism and training on terrorist groups in that area. So this is definitely a direct message for the U.S. To exit and leave Syria.
Iran's large-scale nationwide drone drills continue for a second day. Precision strike drones have successfully destroyed mock enemy targets. The spokesman for the drills says different types of drones have been flown on missions covering vast areas from the Persian Gulf in the south all the way to the country's east, west, north, and center. According to Admiral Mahmoud Mousavi, the drills represent the capabilities of a range of domestically manufactured drones in offensive and defensive scenarios. The Army's ground, naval, Air Force, and Air Defense Forces are taking part in the first ever combined drills. More than 150 surveillance and combat drones are being put to the test for their control systems and combat capabilities. On the first day, the UAVs carried out intelligence gathering and patrol missions.
The Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drones. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 joint drone exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasir, Sadiq, Yazdan and Ababil 3 tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles. Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone as well as Muhajir 6 were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition and reconnaissance missions. It can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has, for some time now, shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
Iran's advancements came to the fore in March when it unveiled an underground drone base. Back then, military officials stated that 60 drones could fly out of the base at the same time. Now Iran says the ongoing drills exhibit only a small fraction of the progress that the army has made in mastering the drone technology.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere.
And so it's drones and the technology and the tactics are adapted to these realities. And so, it's one thing, though, to have theoretical knowledge. It's another to have practical. And these exercises, I think, take Iran's drones and allows the Iranian military to practice using these drones in realistic scenarios that will make these drones more effective if Iran is ever called upon to use them in a conflict.
Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones.
It's the height of hypocrisy, hubris-based hypocrisy, for the United States, Israel, or any Western nation that incorporates drone technology into their operations to call out Iran for developing their own drone capability and employing these drones in support of Iranian backed actions in the region. The United States invented the armed drone, and the United States has used armed drones extensively throughout its involvement in the Middle East and Central Asia and elsewhere.
Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mehraj 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
Iran says it's reviewing the U.S.'s response to its comments on an EU draft proposal to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani has confirmed the receipt of Washington's response to the European Union. He says that Tehran is carefully reviewing the response and will convey its final thoughts to the EU coordinator. There's still some gaps between Iran and the U.S. with regard to the revival of the agreement. Several rounds of talks coordinated by the EU have been held between Iran and the other signatories for nearly 16 months. Iran has been demanding sanctions relief, economic guarantees, as well as assurances that the U.S. will not withdraw from the pact again. We have talked to Tehran University Professor Fawad Izadi about reaching an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA. He believes the U.S. behavior toward the restoration of the deal has proven that it is not trustworthy.
You cannot trust the United States today or tomorrow or ever, given the history of the United States since the United States independence. We are not talking about the issue of trust. We are talking about reaching an agreement. And from the reports that we are seeing, Iran has given up on a lot of demands that Iran had. In the interest of actually having an agreement. Iran has been extremely flexible when it comes to what Iran has been demanding. And the reason is to give the United States no excuse. The reason you see the European foreign policy chief siding with Iran in the last week is because of that flexibility that Iran has shown. And it's the United States that you cannot trust. And that statement that they had with regard to wanting to return to the agreement, that's also very much in question with the way they have been behaving in the last few days.
The Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement says resistance groups remain united in the face of Israel's aggression.
The jihad movement specifically, and Hamas and other resistance factions were a supportive ground for this backing, and they also were observing the movement of Saraya al-Quds and the Islamic Jihad in its face-off with the enemy. And our unity is based on a united operations room, and we together are united as one in the face of the enemy and the face of any aggression. And here, allow me.
Ziad al-Nakhala said Palestinians will continue to defend their cause, will spare no effort to liberate their land from the Israeli occupation. He condemned the desecration of the Palestinian holy sites by Israeli forces and settlers. Nakhala said the Palestinians are determined to end the violations of their sanctities by the regime. Moving on, Russia says its military has killed over 200 Ukrainian troops in a railway station attack in central Ukraine.
As a result of a direct hit by an Iskander missile on a military train at the Chaplin railway station, more than 200 servicemen of the reserve of Ukraine's armed forces and 10 units of military equipment were destroyed.
Spokesman Igor Konashenkov says a high-precision missile hit a military train on Wednesday at Chaplin Station. The Russian Defense Ministry official said the station was to deliver arms to Ukrainian forces on the front line in Donbas. Kiev rejects Russia's claim, saying that the strike has targeted at least 25 civilians and set five train carriages ablaze. With the latest strike fueling the battle near Zaporizhia nuclear plants, concerns remain over risking a nuclear disaster. Earlier, the UN called for the area to be demilitarized. The International Atomic Energy Agency has been seeking to gain access to the facility. Moving on to the pain and suffering endured by the Rohingya Muslim refugees. They have rallied across squalid refugee camps in Bangladesh, marking 5 years since they fled a brutal military crackdown in Myanmar. The refugees, children and the elderly alike, marked what they call Genocide Remembrance Day. They demanded a safe return to their home state of Rakhine in western Myanmar. The refugees blamed the international community for turning a blind eye to their plight. In August 2017, about 750,000 members of the Muslim minority escaped the military crackdown, which is now the subject of a landmark genocide case at the UN's top court. Save the Children said on Wednesday, the Rohingya fled mass killings, rape, and systematic human rights abuses in Myanmar. The Rohingya are described as the world's most persecuted minority. Floods triggered by massive monsoon rains have ravaged Pakistan. Over 900 people have died since mid-June. The country's disaster agency says that at least 126 people were killed in the past 2 days alone. Overall, some 50,000 people are now left homeless. Sindh and Balochistan provinces have been the hardest hit. The floods have inundated farmlands, destroying crops, homes, roads, and bridges. Pakistan is also struggling to cope with the massive costs of reconstruction. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif called on the international community to help with relief efforts and to send assistance. The national rainfall in July was well above average, making it the wettest the country has seen in six decades. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Nasser Kazmi from the Pakistani capital Islamabad for an update on the impacts of flash floods in the country.
The spokesman of Pakistan's government, she said that the emergency has been declared in all the four provinces, and the government is appealing to the people to help the flood-affected people in this situation. Meanwhile, the more rain is expected in four provinces in next 48 hours. So the situation is getting very alarming. And meanwhile, we have reports that the internet services and the other communication services have been affected by this flood. And the government is trying to cope the situation, but the rains are continuously, hitting those areas. That's why there are some problems. People are homeless. They don't have shelter to live at the moment, and the rescue operation is underway to help the flood-affected people.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan accuses the government of trying to score a, quote, technical knockout. Khan has been granted bail on charges brought under the Anti-Terrorism Act.
How Pakistan was mocked across the world after it made headlines and gave an impression as if Pakistan was a banana republic. And there is no law here, and any charges can be brought against anyone. They try to arrest a person who is the head of a leading political party. Those who are taking the decisions and those who are behind it should think about this country.
Mahan's court appearance is the latest twist in months of political wrangling in Pakistan that began when he was ousted by a vote of no confidence. The former cricket star retains widespread support and has staged mass rallies against Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif's government. After weeks of political saber-rattling, Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e Insaf party says he has been granted interim bail until September the 1st. But Khan says the government is afraid of his popularity. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Climate experts warn temporary increases in water levels in the U.S. Southwest will not mitigate the water crisis and drought that have been years in the making. We're prepared for you an article written by Gabriel Cannon. The piece is titled, Flash Floods Wreak Havoc in U.S. Southwest, but are no salve for drought. Flash floods hitting the American Southwest in recent days have shuttered parts of national parks, including in Moab and Zion, closed highways in Colorado, submerged cars in Texas, and trapped tourists in a New Mexico cave. A young woman remains missing after being swept away while hiking in Zion on Friday, 19th of August. But experts say the destructive deluges have not been enough to relieve the drought and the continued pressure on water resources. Even strong storms are unable to overcome dry conditions that are decades in the making. Summer monsoons are a natural feature of the southwest of the United States, and the parched landscapes can typically rely on this annual reprieve. But the intensity between the wet and dry extremes is increasing, along with the destruction that both can cause. As the world warms, scientists predict the effects will worsen. Dr. Andrew Hull, a meteorologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, Physical Sciences Laboratory, said, "There is a duality in the effect of climate change and the hydrologic cycle, noting that the heavy rains and underlying drought conditions exist on separate timescales. It will take a sustained rainy season over the cold winter months to crack the conditions, and forecasts aren't causing much optimism for the months ahead. Dried soils are also less able to absorb the added moisture when storms are severe." Dr. Andrew Hull said, "We are already in a pretty tough spot where we have low water reserves in our lakes and reservoirs, despite the fact that it looks like we have had a small and temporary reprieve because of some active monsoon rains. The rain has also caused widespread destruction and put people in danger." Authorities had been searching for Jetal Agnihotri, a 29-year-old of Tucson, Arizona, who was reported missing after being swept away by floodwaters in Utah's Zion National Park. The park spokesman, Jonathan Schaefer, said in a news release, "Her body was discovered on Monday, 22nd of August, about 6 miles south of the area where she was swept away, ending a 4-day search." Jonathan Schaefer said, "Our search and rescue operation is ongoing. We have searchers in the field again, and we are working closely with the National Weather Service to monitor the forecast, and we're going to pay close attention to that going forward." Jetal Agnihotri was among several hikers who were swept off their feet on Friday afternoon, 19th of August, by rushing water in the popular Narrows area in the park, known for its spectacular red rock cliffs and narrow canyons in southern Utah near the Arizona border. Riverside Walk and the Narrows remain closed. Meanwhile, in New Mexico, officials at Carlsbad Caverns National Park said about 150 tourists were evacuated late on Saturday night, 20th of August, after being stranded by rising water. Park officials told people at the visitor center to wait there for hours because of flash floods. In Arizona, emergency crews rescued 4 hikers stranded in Sabino Canyon, east of Tucson, on Friday, and helped 41 students and staff from Marana off school buses that got stuck in high water when the storms began to move. A slow-moving storm dumped record amounts of rain on the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas, prompting rescues from the rising waters. A state of disaster was declared in Dallas County on Monday evening, 22nd of August, after the area got nearly the amount of rain in one day as typically falls over the entire summer. Texas officials have reported a fatality from storms after a pulling an unidentified woman from the waters. The incident is under investigation, but first responders said they believe she died after her car was swept away by flash floods. Severe storms were just the latest to take a toll on the region, which produced a major flash flood from Death Valley earlier this month and pushed the Navajo Nation to declare a state of emergency. Parts of Yellowstone National Park are still in recovery from the multi-million dollar destruction caused by record rains in June, and debris flows forced New Mexico residents hit by early season catastrophic wildfires to evacuate for the second time in mere months. The latest U.S. Drought Monitor summary said, after an extended period of serious drought, the heavy rains have prompted broad-scale improvement in monsoon-affected areas. The benefits included a boost in levels at the beleaguered Lake Mead, which rose 2 feet over the weekend. While those precious inches are promising, the reservoir remains only 27% full and is precariously close to hitting a level at which it can no longer generate hydroelectric power. Even with a strong monsoon in the southwest of the United States, more than half of America's West remains categorized in severe drought by the U.S. Drought Monitor. Calling drought a cascading hazard, Dr. Andrew Howell cautioned that these rains won't spell the end of dry times, especially with forecasts showing little hope for a badly needed wet winter. He said, "Folks within this region might be seeing increases in water levels and perhaps letting their guard down. Just because you have a couple of weeks or couple of months of good precipitation during the summertime, that doesn't mean the lake levels are even close to coming to average." He noted, "We are still in the midst of a huge drought." Furthermore, scientists say it's been a brutal summer so far in western United States, where wildfires and severe drought have emerged as a growing threat. As spells of excessive heat become more frequent, the strain on power and water utilities will become more acute. Just recently, the federal government ordered water cutbacks across several western states to protect the beleaguered Colorado River. California's grid operator made similar power usage requests during the summers and falls over the last 2 years, when the region experienced several bouts of record-breaking hot weather. Power systems withstood heat waves in 2021, but rolling blackouts for 2 days in August of 2020 left about 400,000 households without electricity. On Wednesday, 17th of August, the California grid operator projected power demand would peak at 44,919 megawatts, the highest since September of 2020, when usage hit 47,236 megawatts. 1 megawatt can power around 1,000 U.S. homes on a typical day, but only about half of that on a hot summer day. As a result, power prices during the day in Southern California and in Washington State could climb to their highest points since September of 2021. The heat is also raising the risk of wildfires. The Wishon Fire, a 350-acre blaze in the Sequoia National Forest, was 35% contained. On Tuesday, 23rd of August, the U.S. government warned that more drastic cuts in water usage were needed to protect dwindling supplies held in reservoirs that are crucial to the well-being of 7 western states. 2 reservoirs, that is Lake Mead and Lake Powell, have fallen to just above 1/4 of their capacity this summer. Authorities say if they fall much further, the lakes will be unable to generate hydroelectric power for millions of people in western United States. The U.S. National Weather Service said in Big Bar, an unincorporated area of Northern California, for instance, temperatures could reach 43 degrees Celsius in these days, while further north, residents in Electric City, Washington, could see temperatures of 105 degrees Fahrenheit.
Hidden Files. I grew up in the United States with a counting song that went like this. 1 little, 2 little, 3 little Indians, 4 little, 5 little, 6 little Indians, 7 little, 8 little, 9 little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. Now this was supposed to be a song for kids to learn how to count. And the other part of it is they dive in the boat, and the boat turns over. 10 little, 9 little, 8 little Indian boys, and continues. If one thinks about what is being said, it is shocking, but as a kid, I just mimicked the lyrics like the other kids, not realizing the overall effect. I also grew up being shown Indian savages on westerns and how the poor white man just wanted to live in peace and develop the land that he had discovered. But the Redskins would not let them live in peace. This is the other process, meaning dehumanizing people. And these are just 2 examples of the way the original inhabitants of North America, the natives, were demonized and discounted, even up to this day, in what is now the United States. From the time the European colonizers stepped foot on that land, the white man saw the natives as less than themselves. They were less human, less smart, less civilized, less deserving, which led to the invaders being able to forcibly remove and exterminate much of the original population of the land a lot easier. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. Today we will be looking at the original inhabitants of North America, the natives. I am Marzia Hashimi. Welcome. Well, the natives had lived on that land for tens of thousands of years. In 1492, when Columbus actually landed there, there were 112 million indigenous people. 112 million indigenous people. Keep that number in mind, because as we fast forward and we go to 1650, we have gone from that number of 112 million to 6 million people. Imagine that. by 1650. Unfortunately, the tragedy is so multifaceted. We look at then from between 1776 to 1887, and 1.5 billion acres of native land was stolen. This is the story, only part of the tragedy of the natives. From being free to roam and live on over a billion acres to being forced to live on reservations, this became the reality for most natives who didn't die at the hands of the colonizers. Reservations were set up by the whites to control the native population, while at the same time more of their land could be stolen. Harsh measures were implemented, and brainwashing and miseducation were techniques used, as well as the Christianization of the natives on the reservations. Now, the land that the Europeans forced the natives to live on usually was not as fertile as the land they were used to having, or was the type of terrain that they were not familiar with. And many different tribes were thrown together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of Native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
Small. They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick? You know, there's alcoholism, there's, you know, there's abuse, there's domestic violence. There's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Yeah. Prison. It's like where we're trapped.
I think it's the most common misconception about reservations.
That there's some kind of abundance, that Natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people and hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair, because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped? It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland. And so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. And I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there, and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore, because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions, youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad indeed, and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guest onto this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comacrudo tribe. Juan is the eldest born to a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comacrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapo nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapo Traditional Tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pahwa Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles. And there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles that was brought here by the colonization. And that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate, the colonizers that were here. And so for a long time, I think, I know that a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission, and that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression in this area has been, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to. They were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, hanging us and to try to. So those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of the Southwest were another one of those. To the Southwest and through California, they were very oppressive to who you are, who we are, and they outlawed a lot of our ceremonies.
And I mean, what would you say are some of the main problems that natives still face today?
And that's what they did here with the doctrine of discovery. They said if we don't believe the way they do or live the way they do, that they could kill us. And that's what they did for a long time. And here in Texas, up until the 1940s, they were still killing us. And they were finding ways to take away the land, and that's how they did it. And there's still a high percentage of prisons that have a large percentage of people of color. That should tell you something too. But they still want to control what they're. And if you speak very loudly, you get. They'll find ways to get you. So, thing is that they like their system the way it is, and it's only for them. And for the rest of us are just supposed to suck it up, And that's no longer the question here. I'm not here to make the white man comfortable anymore. I'm here to make my people comfortable. So,
and with that, we appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Well, stay tuned. We're going to welcome our next guest to the program right after this.
Terrence Nelson, Vice Chairman of the American Indian Movement. Terrence is also spokesman for the Oki-Ida Warrior Society. He's former chief of Roseau River Anishinaabe First Nation and has written numerous books and booklets.
Thank you so much for joining us here at Hidden Files. How are reservations still being used today, in your perspective, to repress natives?
Well, one of the things is that you can't pledge any lands. You don't have access to the banks because you can't pledge anything on a reservation land. You're denied access to the economy. So United States, the indigenous peoples living on reservations are probably, they're the most impoverished people because it's deliberately set out like that so that the indigenous people don't have the money to fight the system that they find themselves in. So it is it's economic repression.
Well, there are so many tragic events in Native history. One is the Trail of Tears, even significant by its name. Can you talk about this event and others that you think may even affect your people today?
Well, on the Trail of Tears, they just rounded them right up, and they force marched them to Oklahoma, but that was only one area where they ended up doing that. Amongst the Dakotas and North Dakota, South Dakota, they basically rounded up the people and they forced them onto reservations. And then when they didn't want to do that, like there was lots of different, highlights in history where the indigenous people fought back. That's why you have names like Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and those ones that like Geronimo, and those ones that have come through history that fought back. They fought back, and they were just small groups of people most of the time. They didn't have a lot of weapons and guns and things like that. They basically fought back as best they could. And the United States Army was extremely well equipped. They had all kinds of manufacturing of Gatling guns. They had all kinds of cannons. They had mounted horses and armies and fighting against people that were just essentially had to. They hauled their women and their children and their living, and they basically slaughtered all of the buffalo so that the indigenous people didn't have anything to eat. But there was those are things that people don't understand. Yeah, when you don't have anything to eat, when you have your children, you're looking at your children that are starving, and you're trying to fight back. Well, that's what the indigenous people did, and that Trail of Tears you talk about, that's what they did. They essentially force marched them, and they fed them whatever little that they had, and then they basically just. The indigenous people were falling off and they were dying. It was because when you, as a parent or as a grandparent, when you see these little kids dying, how horrible is that? People don't understand that. The policies even extended to the residential school area, they call it here in Canada, but in the American side, it was called the boarding schools, where our Native Americans were essentially taken from their homes when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and taken to a school run by the churches and run by the, and they were forcibly indoctrinated into Christianity, and they were told that they were devil worshippers. These kids. That their parents were heathens and everything else like that. So that's the way that they were taught. What's tragic right now is that the Native Americans and our people are, we don't know the true history of what happened to our people because the one that controls history or the textbooks and the is the ones that essentially write the books, and it is the Europeans that wrote the books. So the Trail of Tears is not well known in the U.S. school system, and then they kind of come along and they tell these young white people that
the Native Americans are dependent people, that they get their free money from the United States government and everything else like that. Meanwhile, nobody talks about all of the resources that are sold to keep the to subsidize the Native the American lifestyle. So the gold, the silver, uranium, platinum, oil, trees, water, everything that is now owned by the Europeans and sold to everybody else, they don't pay it to the indigenous people. They pay it to the corporations and to the governments that sell these products. But it is originally owned by the indigenous people.
Indeed, it is a sad story what happens and continues to happen to the indigenous people. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. Well, I started off this program by talking about so-called poems and TV shows that ignore the humanity of the natives. And this is still a problem and is endemic of settler colonialism. When it is said that they, the white man, the European, discovered this nation and that they birthed a nation from nothing, these lies add to the facade of white supremacy. Now, the very roots of the United States were laid by Native and African genocide and displacement. When in its own constitution, Thomas Jefferson writes about the merciless Indian savages, how likely can we expect a change in the way Washington deals with the original people of that land? As violence is the foundation of white supremacy and imperialism is nourished by exploitation, it is more likely that viewing and treating natives as less than will continue. So it is the natives themselves who must continue to demand their rights and not remain silent. I end this program with a quote from a native chief, Hedmat Toyolakat, who said, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade, where I choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. Otherwise, it seems that resistance is the only way." We will definitely be continually to bring you the latest on the natives. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.